Hello and Happy New Year! Welcome to this week's Dialect. We're coming to you from Queen's Road Studio on this wintry New Year's afternoon. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, and not only that, our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2, and also to our listeners in St Albans on Radio Verulam, and also to our other listeners in Swindon, and also possibly Columbia as well, we're told. This week we'll be talking to Susie Parr. Susie has written a book on the history of swimming, and she'll be telling us more about how the fashion for swimming has started and also declined, possibly in sync with the decline of seaside towns economically. And we also hear about wild swimming, the new cult. Our roving reporter Anthea Page speaks to Tom Mogg, superintendent for many years at Bristol North Swimming Pool, continuing the swimming theme, apt for any of you taking a charity New Year dip. Tony Gosling will be speaking to Sabine McNeil, who runs a campaign to right injustices in English courts. We also have a tribute to Malcolm Beecham, who was interviewed by us earlier this year by Alec, who tragically lost his life in the M5 motorway crash at the fireworks weekend, which you will remember in the news. So I'm going to replay that interview. The swashbuckling adventure Treasure Island continues, as ever brought to life by Malcolm Grieve. Charles Thompson also reads us one of his poems, and Jeff Sparks has his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman. Interviewed by us earlier this year by Alec, who tragically lost his life in the M5 motorway crash at the fireworks weekend, which you will remember in the news. So I'm going to replay that interview. The swashbuckling adventure Treasure Island continues, as ever brought to life by Malcolm Grieve. Charles Thompson also reads us one of his poems, and Jeff Sparks has his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman. It's my pleasure to introduce Susie Parr. Hello.
Hi there.
Tell me a little bit about yourself as an author. Have you ever written anything before this book?
Yes, I have actually. I work with people with aphasia, which is a communication problem that can follow stroke. So I've written quite a few books about that, but this was a complete departure from that work.
So tell me a little bit about your interest in swimming, because you've written a history or a story of swimming. You're obviously quite an enthusiast.
I am. I'm a passionate swimmer. I've always loved swimming outdoors in sort of rivers, lakes and seas. And that's really why I started the book, because I wanted to know why is it so important to me. And also I felt it was slightly in decline. I seemed to be the only person in the sea, even on a busy bank holiday on Britain's beaches. Yeah. So I wanted to really kind of explore what's behind it all, and also try and sort of really celebrate a culture which I think we're in danger of losing.
Okay, I mean, how far back do you think swimming goes, and how far did you go back for your story?
Well,
does it say it's part of our evolutionary story even?
Yes. Well, I didn't go back as far as sort of the fish emerging from the slime and all that, but I did go back to the Romans and actually the pre-Romans. In fact, the Romans brought swimming as a military manoeuvre, military skill, and they used to surprise the British tribes by swimming across rivers, because of course there were no bridges at that time, and then attacking them and sort of killing their horses and things like that. So they had Germanic tribes working with them as mercenary, and they were very good swimmers. The soldiers were very good swimmers.
So we have contemporary accounts of swimming from that time?
Yes, we do. And we have also, obviously, within Anglo-Saxon poetry, there's Beowulf. There are several swimming episodes in that. That's also a kind of military style of swimming. But there's also the magical swimming in Beowulf in the Anglo-Saxon poetry, where Beowulf dives down to kill Grendel's mother. So there's a lot of myth around swimming right from the very earliest days.
How do you manage and construct researching a topic? I mean, swimming, your research could go on forever and cover an incredible variety of countries and timescales. How on earth do you manage all
this? Yes, well, I limited it to the UK. That's what I felt qualified to look at. But of course, I was absolutely amazed by how much there was. So I had to be quite kind of linear in terms of timescale, chronological, really. And then I had to make myself very disciplined, just do 3 months of research for each chapter, 3 months to write it, 3 months to edit it.
Okay. So the first encounters with swimming seem to be mainly military and to do with war. I mean, when do we start seeing swimming becoming more of a pleasurable activity?
Well, it's really interesting. In the 18th century, well, 17th century, actually, some of the doctors in Scarborough discovered that bathing in seawater was as good for people as bathing in the kind of mineral waters of spa towns like Harrogate and Bath, and actually more healthy in a way, because it was rather a fetid stew in places like Bath. Yeah. So they recommended that the infirm would bathe and then take exercise, actually drink seawater as well as bathe in it. But of course, that was only for the really wealthy, the wealthy invalids who could afford to come and have bathing machines and that kind of thing.
Just talking, what's a bathing machine? What's to stop you just sort of wading out?
A bathing machine was to protect people's modesty, so they could change in the machine. The machine would be drawn out into the sea by horses, and then the person could emerge from the other end of the machine into the waves and be dipped by a dipper.
Right, so the idea that you just sort of, you know, walk into the sea and just go for a swim would be rather common.
Well, that wouldn't have happened, and it certainly didn't happen prior to the sea bathing for health thing. But that seemed to become, I imagine it was initially a bit of a medicinal and rather unpleasant experience, but people started to enjoy it. And Jane Austen, for example, was a great lover of sea bathing.
Right.
And of course, all the romantic poets at the same time were kind of looking at bathing, looking at one's relationship with the natural landscape in a very different way.
I mean, I've sort of detected there's obviously a gap between the way you're talking about the Romans and up to the 17th century. Does that mean there's a sort of swimming dark ages?
Well, there was the really with the mounted knights, the middle ages, because of course they couldn't swim because of their huge weight of their armour would make them sink. But I have discovered that in 1595, Sir Everard Digby wrote a manual about swimming in Latin, De Arte Natandi, that was translated into English for the riffraff by Christopher Middleton. And that's a very kind of practical thing that most swimmers today would recognise. It's really very much about looking out for obstructions, finding an easy way out of your swimming place.
What was his motivation for writing it?
It was to stop the youth of Cambridge, that's where he was based, from drowning, basically, because people would sort of cool off in the river in the summer, and there was quite a lot of drowning. So it was a real practical manual. So it's a delightful kind of insight into everyday life on the riverbank of Elizabethan England.
When do we see the first signs of competitive swimming, as in sort of like an Olympic sport?
Well, I think that probably started with the kind of regulation of the administrative brilliance of the Victorians and Edwardians, because they obviously started to build pools, and that meant that you could measure the distance. They started to regulate strokes. So they kind of formalised and regulated strokes, and then they started to time people. So it really kind of emerged from that time, I think.
Fast forwarding to the modern day, I noticed that a lot of the idea of swimming as a pleasure is related to the seaside, and seaside resorts are quite commonly known to be in hard times at the moment. Do you feel that this fading of the art of swimming is related to that somehow?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, you know, the British seaside resorts went into a serious decline in the last part of the 20th century due to pollution, the fact that there were so many indoor pools, foreign holidays, nice warm seas elsewhere. So it did go into decline, but there has been a revival. You're probably aware of the wild swimming movement, which
I'm
is
not
sort
actually,
of no.
No,
well, that's tell, really
tell,
interesting.
Listeners not to know about it.
It's something that's happened in the last decade, where young people have started to embrace the idea of entering into rivers, lakes and seas again, and made it kind of cool and glamorous. So there's a sort of zeitgeist about wild swimming.
So tell me, the pleasure that you get from swimming is definitely related to, you know, the wild waters and natural waters, mm-hmm. rather than sort of the artificial confines of an indoor swimming pool. Explain to me what the pleasures are that define that for you and make it special.
Well, for me, I find it has huge psychological benefits. It eases stress. If your mood is low, it lifts your mood. You physically feel better. And I become quite addicted. I swim here in Bristol at the Henley's Lake, which sadly is closed over the winter season. But I just have to go every day and dip in the cold water.
Is it anywhere, I mean, David Walliams has swum down the Thames and has famously got a hideous amount of diseases. Is it actually safe? How can you tell if it's safe to go swimming somewhere?
Well, that's a difficult question. I mean, there is a lot of issue around access, health and safety. That's another reason why, in a way, swimming went into decline, because of the health and safety kind of movement in the late 80s and 90s. Yes, absolutely. And actually, very sadly, if you go to somewhere like Byron's Pool in Grantchester, where Lord Byron swam near Cambridge, there's a big Environment Agency notice saying, Byron's Pool, no swimming.
How sad.
Because it's dangerous currents, that kind of thing.
What could be done to try and encourage swimming again if seaside resorts are finding it pretty tough going?
I don't know. I'm not sure it is going to recover, to be honest. When I'm the only one in at Tenby or somewhere, yeah. You know, which beautiful water, lovely clean water, you don't really see other people in.
Okay. Tell me about how you got the book published. I mean, was it difficult to attract interest in the idea of a book about swimming?
It was many years before I managed to find a publisher. I've been working on it for 10 years and it was difficult to find a publisher. I eventually found a photographic publisher who are very, very good at sort of producing images, and they really loved the idea of the story of swimming and my own personal story woven into it. And they've done the most fantastic job in producing this book because it's full of imagery as well as the text. It's got woodcuts, engravings, cartoons, and of course contemporary photographs.
At least if you attract a few more people to the cult of wild swimming, you'll be a very happy person.
Will indeed,
okay.
Yes.
How can people get hold of the book?
Well, you can buy it in any good bookshop. It's in Waterstones and all those bookshops, but you can also get it on Amazon.
Okay, so Susie Parr, S-U-S-I-E and Parr, P-A-R-R?
Yes.
Yep, that's your name, that's how to find it, and it's called...
The Story of Swimming.
The Story of Swimming. Well, Susie Parr, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
A few months back, we interviewed a gentleman named Malcolm Beecham talking about a group he was involved with, the Company of Chivalry. Very sadly, he passed away in the M5 motorway accident near Taunton in the last couple of months. So we wanted to play this interview again as a sort of memorial to him. He was a very animated, friendly man, and he wanted to take this chance to share what he loved doing, and we want to take this chance to remember him. And our thoughts go out to his family.
Our guest this week is Malcolm Beecham from the Company of Chivalry.
Hello there.
Hello, Malcolm. Can you tell me, what is the company all about?
Well, basically, the Company of Chivalry was formed way back in 1988, and it basically brings people who have a love of history to life. We meet most weekends throughout the summer period, and we try to recreate the medieval period from 1370 to 1390. And we try to give people a hands-on approach to play with the weapons, come and speak to our people, get involved in the activity which is actually happening on any particular day we do an event.
And why is there such interest in this medieval reenactment?
Well, within any reenactment, you can have any period you like. Obviously, we portray the medieval period because it's a period we all like as a group of about 60 people. We love that particular period. But there are various other periods. You know, you can go from the Stone Age right up to World War II. So whichever area you wish to devise your interest in, you can go in that. But the medieval period is very interesting, certainly from an English history point of view, because so many things happened. You know, we had battles with basically everybody on the planet, to be perfectly honest, particularly, you know, the French against the Scots and against the Welsh. So we try to portray and bring that life into a scene so people can see what went on.
And with the reenactment, is it the military side of it or is it everyday life that you deal with?
We do all of it. We do the medieval life of people, you know, from cooks to people making coins to a doctor on site. So we portray the living history camp all whilst we're on site. We also are a military camp, which I basically then portray all the soldiers for John of Gaunt. That's the household we follow. So again, we portray soldiers drilling, we're fighting, combat, we'll have full armoured knights, but also a social side. So it shows the social effects of the medieval period during the period as well. So we try to bring the whole period to life in one foul swoop, and we do various events throughout the year.
And the range of reenactors, are they from all walks of life?
Yes, they are. We have age groups from sort of a six-month-old baby up to 70-year-olds. They go across a span of doctors, solicitors, lorry drivers. And, you know, we welcome members from every walk of life, to be perfectly honest, because you need that mix. The beauty of what we all love is that we all love history and we all love the medieval period. And that's what brings us together most weekends for the summer period.
And you're based in Bristol, Weston-super-Mare, I believe.
That's right, yeah. Most of our memberships come from the Weston, Bristol area. But again, we take members from all over the country, so some people will travel from further afield as well.
Right, so do you occupy a castle when you go for a reenactment?
Yes, we do. We do a lot of events with Cadw, which is obviously the Welsh heritage, who looks after a lot of the Welsh castles. We're heavily involved with Caerphilly Castle, particularly in South Wales. We go to Scotland, but we also do an event in Italy as well. So we will travel anywhere, wherever there needs to be an event put on, and we will portray that period throughout wherever we end up going. So we try to bring the castles to life, because when there's nothing going on, they're beautiful buildings to look at, but there's nothing to actually see what's going on in them. So if we can bring them to life with fighting, with combat, with the fires, the cooking and the smells and the music from the period, people do enjoy and can actually see it in its true glory.
Mm-hmm. So the costumes that and the equipment that you have, is this material that you make yourself?
Yes, basically all the costumes and the footwear, underclothing, chainmail, we tend to make all ourselves. We do use specialist companies for some of the weapons, particularly swords, and we use a specialist company to make our authentic tents, because whilst we're on site, we actually stay on site, so obviously we need somewhere to live, so everything else is then made within the group. So somebody who wants to make arrows would then do a trade by saying, I'll make you some arrows, but I'm also good at making some shoes. So there'd be some swaps so people can use each other's skills to try and portray what also happened in the period, because everything we make is, we try to keep it as authentic as we can, from the stitching to the feathers we use on and all the clothing types we use.
So there must be a lot of research goes into this.
A lot of research. We're in London quite a lot, because a lot of certainly the clothing finds which we tend to use for research are obviously from the Thames, dug up because they've managed to preserve themselves in the muds. So yeah, a lot of research. But again, history can change. If suddenly we're going along and somebody finds something, comes to us and say, we found some different history. So history can change. It's whatever they dig up, it's whatever they find. So we're always open to ideas from the public, because the public can have something we don't know. And that's what gives it the beauty, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm. I've got a personal interest in history. Is it something that you are perhaps involved with a time team, maybe? Another time team on television?
Yes, we have worked with a time team on numerous occasions of research. We have actually a medieval doctor, actually within our group, is actually a real doctor in real life, and he has done lots of work with the time team crew. So again, we also get involved in lots of films and extras as films. We actually do a lot of research for film companies as well, because a lot of the American film companies come over here to obviously make a lot of their medieval films. So we try to give them assistance and help and actually supply extras as well.
And funding, how do you fund the group?
Basically, the group is a non-for-profit group, so all individuals do it as a hobby. There's no payment for individuals to actually do this. It's purely their hobby. As a society, we will set a figure or a fee, and we will charge whoever we're supplying that to. Again, it's not huge amounts of money. It's really just to cover the cost of the society, insurance, vans, and some of the equipment. But most of the equipment, to be perfectly honest, is owned by individuals. So it can mount up to many thousands of pounds over time, the amount of money you spend on equipment, depending on what level you want to be within the society.
And health and safety must form a strong part of what you do, because there's a lot of activity with swords and weaponry.
Yeah, health and safety will always play a part in any modern life nowadays, and obviously we can never get away from that. But again, you've got to have a common sense approach. All of our soldiers, all the combat people, they're fully trained. Most of the winter period is spent around the Bristol area, up on the Downs, basically trying to make sure that the weapons they're using, the swords, are actually training, but also training from an authentic point of view. So they would generally come into society at 7 or 8 years old, train for 4, 5, 6 years and gradually work their way up to the level which is competent on the battlefield. Can we also do get involved in other huge battles like the Battle of Tewkesbury, which is on in the 8th and 9th of July. There's 2,000 reenactors on the field, so training plays a major, major part. But we don't get many injuries, to be perfectly honest.
I understand you're involved in an American film that's coming out.
Yeah, there's a film which I think is due out at the end of June called Ironclad. It was filmed a couple of years ago. Now, basically, Ironclad is a reproduction of one of the great sieges during the medieval period, and basically where they used us as a society, we are very specialist in the use of medieval siege warfare, particularly when you look at the trebuchet. The trebuchet was actually used in the film, and we supplied not only the extras, but we also supplied the expertise in actually manufacturing and remaking a full-size trebuchet.
That is an enormous catapult, I believe.
It is enormous. It's what's known as the counterbalance trebuchet. So there's a huge basket of about 3 tons of stone, a long arm, a sling underneath, and it pulls round and then throws a ball to whatever object you used. The actual film was built on the Battle of Rochester, which was quite a battle during the period. Again, it's a very gruesome film, but it is out. It's been into the cinemas. It's out hopefully this week, and certainly go and have a see a copy. You would never identify any of us because, unfortunately, like all things, are makeup in the costume. Costumes are rather hairy people, so it's good to get involved with film companies, because you know they do like our history in this country and they do like the expertise, so definitely well worth a watch.
Right, and if anyone's interested in joining your group, are you still looking for new members?
Yes, we're always looking for new members, because like we say, we welcome members from every age range. Again, you can log on to our website if anybody wants to. It's www.companieschivalry.com, and on there you will see all the details about the company, what we do, there's photographs, everything we get up to, and make any inquiries through there, and we will certainly get back to people. And like we say, we welcome membership from any race, anybody, male, female, children, we welcome them all.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for coming on Dialect.
Okay, no, thank you for the opportunity. Thanks very much.
Thank you to Alec Milne, who was the interviewer in that instance. Following on with our swimming theme, we have the swim song coming up, followed by an interview with Tom Mogg, superintendent for many years at Bristol North Swimming Pool. Tom's father was also a swimming superintendent at Plumstead Baths near the Woolwich Arsenal in London. In this interview, you'll hear how the baths became a makeshift mortuary during the bombing of London.
Swimming, swimming in the the swimming club. When days are hot and days are cold in the swimming club. And stroke, breaststroke, fancy diving too. Oh, don't you think it really is the loveliest thing to do? Swimming, swimming in the
Tom Mogg, born on Blackheath in 1924.
Can you tell us about your father? Because he was superintendent of several baths in South London.
Yes, father was originally in the Royal Navy, where he finished as a petty officer. But he left there in 1919 and obtained a job as a swimming pool attendant at Lorrie Grove Baths. From there he studied for practical qualifications of swimming teachers and Royal Life Saving Society, and he was promoted to branch manager at one of the other premises. From there he applied to Sutton and Cheam and was stepped up in his position. From there he applied to Southampton, and in 1928 he was superintendent of the Southampton Baths. After 2.5 years there, he applied for the London Borough of Woolwich Baths Department, which consisted of the Plumstead Baths, Woolwich Baths and Eltham Baths, and a suite of hot baths over in North Woolwich. He and mother obtained this job, and we lived in a flat provided at the top of the main building, which my bedroom overlooked the entire Woolwich Arsenal at that area. When the war started, the first-class swimmer at Plumstead Baths was changed into a wartime mortuary because they worked out that the number of available mortuaries throughout the city wouldn't cope with the sort of bombing that had occurred during the Spanish Civil War. So net result was that the first-class swimmer was changed into this mortuary with a number of racks in there, and the bodies were all brought in and treated accordingly and eventually buried. The building was supplied with a considerable number of cardboard coffins in three sizes, the male, female and a children's one of about 4 foot long. These coffins were all stored, but they opened up and were quite stout enough that two people carrying one with a body in it could manage it comfortably. When the war started, volunteers were called from amongst the bath staff, there were some 80 in the premises, who would man and learn to operate the mortuary side of it, and the staff were paid extra 7 and 6 a week if they undertook this. So a lot of them, of course, were rather unpracticed in the handling of bodies, but the arrangement was that a small furniture van was used, painted black, and it would attend a bombing site. Any bodies that were there were all put on the furniture van, which was then driven to Plumstead Baths, and the back doors opened of the van and the doors into the first class pool hall or mortuary, and a tarpaulin laid down which the bodies were all tipped on. This second tarpaulin was dragged into the building itself, where there were three washing slabs and running water for the bodies to be cleaned up and prepared for identification. Father, in order to encourage the staff, who found it very upsetting at the start, took to giving them a small tot of rum before the bodies came in. And when he told the town clerk, his immediate boss, that what he was doing, the town clerk said that the committee ought to pay for this rum and put a report to the committee accordingly. While it wasn't received exact with any enthusiasm, the chairman was ordered to go and inspect the premises when this was happening, and it would be on his say-so whether or not the rum would be paid for. The chairman was duly phoned when the next raid occurred and bodies were brought in, and the staff had been instructed by Father Abbott, with their large rum, to make sure the chairman saw everything. Unfortunately, the chairman didn't like the look of all this, and he went whiter and whiter, and in the end ran out into the corridor out of the main pool hall and was sick on the floor. He offered to clean it up, but Father said, "No, staff will do that. Come into my office," where he gave him a large rum. The chairman agreed that the rum should be paid for henceforth.
Tell us about the funny story with the identification.
Well, the everybody which had to be prepared was put on a moving trolley in a Hessian shroud. There were different colour side shrouds, coarse sort of canvas stuff, and taken down to the identification area, which had a curtained window from the public side to the mortuary side. And on one occasion, a lady came up to the one to identify her husband, whose body had been found, and he was certainly identified quite easily because he had all his papers on him and everything was there. However, he had been prepared for identifying by the usual mortician's grease paints. He was looking reasonably well, so she should be able to identify him. But the lady, when she looked, decided, that's not my husband. And however, they showed her all his possessions. They assured her that it was him. So she had another look and finally managed to, oh yes, so it is. She didn't recognise him because he was a sweep in his normal trade, and they'd washed him so well and decorated him, she didn't recognise him when he was clean. So how often that occurred, I don't know, but certainly that was the one father recounted. We also had some German airmen, one of whom unfortunately left his plane when it was shot down, but his parachute didn't open, so his body was brought in. And I know my father gave me a small file of dice in Bakelite that he had on his body, so I have a small souvenir as a memory of Plumstead Bard's mortuary.
Did you ever go in there when your father was working? Did you ever see any of the bodies?
I saw the shrouds. I never actually saw a body without a shroud on it. But we did have one incident occurred. Every night they all slept down in the basements, which were quite large. They worked in shifts throughout the night, so if anything occurred, a person on the duty shift of 2 hours could wake the others. On one occasion, the duty officer came tearing down to the basement. "Come quickly, one's still alive." And all the staff jumped up, ran upstairs, and went into the main hall and listened. And you could distinctly hear... As a result of which, they were searched round. They couldn't put the lights on because the skylights were broken. But they went round with torches and found a large policeman fast asleep on one of the racks. When he was woken up, he said he'd just dozed off. But I personally knew exactly what had happened. He'd been called back. He'd been retired some years, and he didn't know Plumstead Bars was a mortuary. Before the war, I'd left some toys down there in the winter. Father sent me down to collect it, and to my horror, when I got into the pool hall to pick up the bits and pieces, a voice had said, "Who's that? What are you doing here?" And it turned out to be a large policeman, who I explained who I was and put the lights on and all that. Everything went well, and Father found out that what they did was, when they were sent out on patrol, they'd slip a bit of thick wire through the doors, hook hold of the push bar, pull it open, and then go in and have a bit of a kip in the bar's cubicles, which were quite warm, until the sergeant was due round. Then they go out and pretend. And this man had obviously been doing it before the war, and he didn't know about the bodies. Father swore there was a body beside him, but I think he was exaggerating.
Tell me about the Woolwich Arsenal.
My bedroom was right at the top of the building, facing towards the river, and between us in Plumstead and the river was, of course, the Plumstead Marshes and the huge area of the Woolwich Arsenal. I believe it was some 7 square miles all told, and what we could see from there was where the trains went through, the filling sheds, and various other aspects at this end of the Arsenal property. From my bedroom window, you could see each shed in turn, and in between the sheds were wagons full of shells or whatever there. And the arrangement apparently was that no truck should be left inside a filling place. When the bombing started, I was due to go swimming at Greenwich Baths, and I'd got my bicycle out when the sirens went and the bombers came over for the first time. I have a feeling it was early in September in 1940. After the bombs, a lot of bombs had fallen, I went up to my bedroom and looked out, and the filling sheds were blowing up one by one, flames were running along, setting light to the trucks, and the whole place was a burning inferno. It was terrible. Now, when they decided to have Plumstead Baths as a mortuary, the Woolwich Arsenal people said they wouldn't need to use it because they had built a mortuary inside the Arsenal grounds and they had plenty of shelters. Unfortunately, one of some of the first bombs down hit not only the mortuary, but also one of the shelters, and I believe nearly 30 bodies actually came out of the arsenal at that time. The Woolwich was particularly picked out because of the arsenal and the docks and things of that nature there, and as a net result was, we moved out to Bexley to try and get away from it.
Thank you to Anthea Page talking to Tom Mogg about Plumstead Baths in London during the Second World War. It's my pleasure to introduce Charles Thompson to read some poetry. Hello.
Thank you very much. I was travelling home one evening and I realised I needed food, and that's the way my poem's going to start. Travelling home one evening, I realised I needed food. What I want, I thought, is probably not a brew-up, but a fry-up. So there's one place for it, and that's the Co-op. Well, I get there and go all healthy instead. Could I buy this can of tuna and tomatoes? Plus, I said to myself, I'd much sooner have soda water than beer. And to further get me out of this health mess, I've picked up this half-price watercress. And also, I wondered, have I got the means to buy two cans of sardines? Are you a member? Do you want cash back? But stop, there was another message flashing in front of me. Oh, ho, ho. And I'm asked to answer yes or no. And this message has me reeling. It says, are our products appealing? Well, I don't really know. Let me consider first this box of Kingfisher sardines. It's very black and blue, but why not make it an aesthetic sardine? Why not extend our vision of a sardine? Why not have a witty sardine picture? A sardine that represents a philosophical viewpoint, or a postmodernist sardine. This box you've got here, this Kingfisher box, is all black and blue, like ocean and deep ocean. That's just too heavy for a couple of sardine. Let them rest in a light blue box with a hint of yellow. So, I'm sorry, I'm not really sure whether this Kingfisher box of sardines is appealing or not. And I'm sure you don't want me to say much more about it, but I'll have to go away and think and come back to you on this one, of your shop being appealing. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Next, another gripping instalment of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. This is Malcolm Grieve reading another instalment. This is Chapter 29, Part 2.
Silver paused, and I could see by the faces of George and his late comrades that these words had not been said in vain. "That's for number one," cried the accused, wiping the sweat from his brow, for he had been talking with a vehemence that shook the house. "Why, I give you my word, I'm sick to speak with you. You neither sense nor memory, and I leave it to fancy where your mother's was that let you come to see. See, gentlemen of fortune. I reckon tailors is your trade." "Go on, John," said Morgan. "Speak up to the others."
"Ah, the others," returned John. "They're a nice lot, ain't they? You say this cruise is bungled. Ah, by gum, if you could understand how bad it's bungled, you would see we're that near the gibbet that my neck's stiff with thinking of it. You've seen 'em, maybe. Hanged in chains, birds about 'em. Seamen pointing them out as they go down with the tide. Who's that?" says one. "That? Why, that's John Silver. I knowed him well," says another. And you can hear the chains a-jangle as you go about and reach for the other boy. Now that's about where we are. every mother's son of us. Thanks to him, and Hans and Anderson, and other ruination fools of you. And if you want to know about number four and that boy, why, shiver my timbers, isn't he a hostage? Are we a going to waste a hostage? No, not us. He might be our last chance, and I shouldn't wonder. Kill that boy? Not me, mates. And number three. Ah, well, there's a deal to say to number three. Maybe you don't count it nothing to have a real college doctor come to see you every day. You, John, with your head broke? Or you, George Merry, that had the ague shakes upon you not 6 hours agone, and has your eyes the colour of lemon peel to this same moment on the clock? And maybe, perhaps, you didn't know there was a consort coming either. But there is, and not so long till then, and we'll see who'll be glad to have a hostage when it comes to that. And as for number two, and why I made a bargain, well, you came crawling on your knees to me to make it. On your knees you came, you that was downhearted, and you'd have starved too if I hadn't. But that's a trifle. You look there. That's why. And he cast down upon the floor a paper that I instantly recognised, none other than the chart on yellow paper with the three red crosses that I had found in the oilcloth at the bottom of the captain's chest. Why the doctor had given it to him was more than I could fancy. But if it was inexplicable to me, the appearance of the chart was incredible to the surviving mutineers. They leapt upon it like cats upon a mouse. It went from hand to hand, one tearing it from another, and by the oaths and the cries and the childish laughter with which they accompanied their examination, you would have thought not only were they fingering the very gold, but were at sea with it, besides, in safety. "Yes," says one, "that's Flint, sure enough, J.F., on a score below, on a Clovitch of it, so he done ever." "Mighty pretty," said George, "but how are we to get away with it? And us, no ship." Silver suddenly sprang up, and supporting himself with a hand against the wall, "Now I give you warning, George," he cried. "One more word of your sauce, and I'll call you down and fight you." "How? Why, how do I know? You had ought to tell me that, you and the rest that lost me my schooner, with your interference, burn you. But not you. You can't. You ain't got the invention of a cockroach. But civil you can speak, and shall, George Merry. You may lay to that." "That's fair enow," said the old man Morgan. "Fair? I reckon so," said the sea cook. "You lost the ship. I found the treasure. Who's the better man at that? And now I resign, by thunder. Elect whom you please to be your cap'n now. I'm done with it." "Silver," they cried. "Barbecue forever! Barbecue for cap'n!" "Oh, that's the tune, is it?" cried the cook. "George, I reckon you'll have to wait another turn, my friend. And lucky for you, as I'm not a vengeful man. But that was never my way. And now, shipmates, this black spot ain't much good now, is it? Dick crossed his luck and spoiled his Bible. And that's about all." "It'll do to kiss the book on still, won't it?" growled Dick, who was evidently uneasy at the curse he had brought upon himself. "A Bible with a bit cut out," returned Silver derisively. "Not it. It don't bind no more'n a ballad book." "Don't it, though?" cried Dick with a sort of joy. "Well, I reckon that's worth having too." "Here, Jim, here's a curiosity for you," said Silver, and he tossed me the paper. It was a round about the size of a crown piece. One side was blank, for it had been the last leaf. The other contained a verse or two of Revelation, these words among the rest, which struck sharply home upon my mind. "Without are dogs and murderers." The printed side had been blackened with wood ash, which already began to come off and soil my fingers. On the blank side had been written, with the same material, the one word, "Deposed." I have that curiosity beside me at this moment. But not a trace of writing now remains beyond a single scratch, such as a man might make with his thumbnail. That was the end of the night's business.
Soon after, with a drink all round, we lay down to sleep. And the outside of Silver's vengeance was to put George Merry up for sentinel and threaten him with death if he should prove unfaithful. It was long ere I could close an eye, and heaven knows I had matter enough for thought in the man whom I had slain that afternoon, in my own most perilous position, and above all in the remarkable game that I saw Silver now engaged upon. Keeping the mutineers together with one hand, and grasping with the other after every means possible and impossible to make his peace and save his miserable life. He himself slept peacefully and snored aloud, yet my heart was sore for him, wicked as he was, to think on the dark perils that environed and the shameful gibbet that awaited him.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve as ever for diligently reading the next episode of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, and we look forward to the rest. Time for a feature now from Tony Gosling. The Crown Prosecution Service was introduced in an attempt to reduce corruption in the courts, but has it had the opposite effect? Sabine McNeil runs a Truth and Justice campaign because she believes there are still many miscarriages of justice going on. And so Tony Gosling talking to her about her campaign and to a former victim, Vet Maurice Kirk.
My name is Sabine McNeil. I'm a mathematician and system analyst. I used to diagnose software at CERN in Geneva. I came to London with a vision of a peace network of computers and people protecting our planet, and I became, if you like, an online activist. And I've published about 30 websites by now, and I think about 17 relate to money. And the Forum for Stable Currencies that I co-founded with Lord Sudley in 1998. The victims of financial exploitation and legal oppression have been coming to my meetings in Westminster ever since, and I always felt helpless and powerless to do something for them. But gradually, I learned that and how publicity is necessary and also rather healing for them, because there's nobody who kind of listens to their stories.
My name is Maurice Kirk. I was born in Taunton, and I was a veterinary surgeon in Taunton in Somerset. So I then went off to Guernsey, became a commercial pilot before that, and I then finished up working in South Wales, where the troubles got really a lot worse. It was 1992, and I noticed that the police were examining my cars outside my veterinary hospital at night on a regular basis, and I was eventually stopped 35 times to produce my driving documents, and on the 35th occasion, I refused. And I doubt if you've ever heard of somebody winning a court case for refusing to produce his insurance. Well, I won it. But the trouble was, I won over 130 charges, and they've only won about 12. Well, I think it was Voltaire said, you know, when the state get it wrong, it is dangerous to be right. And I have been persecuted for 20 years. And the highlight, which is actually ongoing even today in Cardiff Police Station, is that on the 22nd of June 2009, I'm having a cup of tea in the garden with my family in South Wales, down at near St. Donat's Castle, and the police helicopter and armed police arrive, and then they all disappear. And the following day, they come back, and I am jailed for being in possession of an old antique World War One Lewis machine gun. Well, I had to laugh because I'd been asked by my old friend Brian Trubshaw, no less, of 002 Concorde fame, to fly that very vintage aircraft at Farnborough Airshow. It was a World War One pusher biplane, a DH-2. And they locked me up for 7 months. Now, as soon as I got into prison, they played what we call the gulag card. Because what they do is if you start to resist and you start fighting persecution and what we're calling bullying by the South Wales police with no form of redress. If you want to name a place where I've complained, I've done it. And they tried to get, they got me into a psychiatric hospital. By the first report, the doctor had not even examined me, and he reported to the court that I had significant brain damage. And later on, when the Section 35 of the 1983 Mental Health Act expired, then they had to decide whether I was to go to permanent psychiatric prison or be released. The CPS actually told the judge in my absence, there I was underneath the cells of Cardiff Court. You don't know me, but you can imagine I was trying to break the door down to get into my court case. I rather like criminal court cases. It's somewhere where you can speak your mind and be frightened of no one. I was absolutely terrified. I had been in this psychiatric prison for 3 months at Bridge End, called Coswell Clinic, knowing, due to my age and education from Taunton School, that I could see that there was a plot, a conspiracy. Very dangerous to say the word conspiracy when you're dealing with the state. And I knew that if I didn't work day and night, I was going down for life, IPP, imprisonment for public protection. And I came to court eventually. They didn't send me to Broadmoor, even though the doctor had written in his report that I should be sent to Ashworth High Security Prison. I eventually got to court 8 months later, in January of 2010. And I had the fortunate circumstance of winning the case without giving evidence, without calling witnesses, and without summing up. But when I left the court in Cardiff, my relations and friends had come from all over the country, following my story on my website. I used to do a lot of the aerial photography for the press, right from Fleet Street in the old days down to Land's End. And I operated Kirk Aviation and stunt pilot job and things like that. I have a few friends in Somerset, let's put it that way. The jury were in a bar in the Ha Ha restaurant in Cardiff, and they ran out, and one of the pretty girls put her arms around me and said, come on, hugged me and said, come and join us for a drink. And I said, no, you're part of the jury. You mustn't speak to the jury. It must be illegal. And if it's not, it should be. And anyway, I allowed my friends to go in, and I sat there, and I said, well, all I want is a good Medoc, a nice Centimillon or something like that, and I'm going to sit in the corner and sample some good red French red wine. And I heard them saying that they'd made their mind up on the first day. They said, why wasn't the man who sold you the gun attached to this vintage aeroplane? And the man, 12 years earlier, and the man who bought the aeroplane and gun, who incidentally got it working, why weren't either of them in the dock beside you? That's the level and the standard of deceit that is now rife in our law courts. So I am extremely right wing, and I believe in law and order, and my family know that. But I am now watching judges bending, and I don't like it, and I'm going to fight.
So where do you see the source of the problem? Is it more the police or the Crown Prosecution Service, or is it something more in the judiciary, the courts and the judges?
Nobody seems to tackle the Crown Prosecution Service. It is ultimately the Crown Prosecution's duty. Back in the old days in Taunton, when I used to be the veterinary surgeon for the South Wales Police Force and look after all their dogs, if ever I was in for motoring, it was always a police officer and a local lawyer who used to prosecute. But then they brought in the Crown Prosecution Service to show as if there's some independence on how to deal with the general public. Remember that our country is based on jury service and magistrates from our community, and the legal trade are determined to wipe those two issues out. And the Crown Prosecution hide behind royal charters. Royal charters are totally out of date, and the legal profession are dependent on protection under the Memorandum of Understanding, which is signed between the chiefs of police and the lawyers and barristers, so that if either are committing an offence in a courtroom, on oath, they look after each other. I live in France, I live in Brittany, and I'm studying their Code Napoleon. And I believe there's a time soon when we need to have our complete adversarial system obliterated, because it's a money-making machine driven by avarice.
Former aerial photographer and vet Maurice Kirk and Truth and Justice campaigner Sabine McNeil talking to Daleks Tony Gosling. Ah, it is a pleasure to introduce Jeff Sparks for the What's On Guide and the Song of the Week.
Thank you. Hello, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, January 6th, the Ramonas, who are the UK's original all-girl tribute to the Ramones, will be performing with support from Riot Noise, Radio Nasties and also In the Pacific at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Also on Friday, January 6th, The Fixed will be performing with support from She Ripped and also Retrospects at The Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 8pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Spit Like This. This group is one of the hottest alternative groups around today, and in their career so far have released 6 EPs, 1 compilation album and 1 studio album. Next year they have a new album out titled Normalityville Horror, and here is an exclusive track from that album titled 0 to 60.
The road stretches out.
Yeah.
That was Spit Like This with 0 to 60 from the forthcoming studio album Normalityville Horror. For more information on them, you can check out www.spitlikethis.com. Keeping with Friday, January 6th, Nirvana, who are the UK's only tribute to Nirvana, will be performing at the O2 Academy 2 in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance, doors open at 6:30 p.m. Finally, on Saturday, January the 7th, the Elvis Mania Tribute Show will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. That was all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Our studio guest was Susie Parr, and her book is The Story of Swimming, and it's available on Amazon. Our feature was from Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. We remembered Malcolm Beecham today. Charles Thompson treated us to a poem, and Malcolm Grieve read another episode of Treasure Island. Jess Sparks wrote the What's On Guide and gave us the song of the week, and the studio engineer was Michael Noyce. The producer was Michaela Dennis. If you would like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, which is bcfm.org.uk. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. So from all the team here at Dialect, Happy New Year. And just to play out, by the way, we're going to hear a little bit of Sky Martyr by Tim Burrows.